I asked Steve last week if he had anything special he wanted me to hit in this introduction, and he said he had a lot to cover and I should keep it short. So without further ado, here are my colleagues, Nancy Kerner and Steve Lahn, and live via satellite, Brenda Gunderson and Emily Puckett Rogers.
Well, I'm Nancy Kerner, and I'm on the faculty at the University of Michigan in the chemistry department, and my co-PI is Brenda Gunderson, who's on the faculty in statistics. And we're really excited to share the results of this project that's in its fourth year. The project goal was to improve education by integrating, infusing into our large introductory courses learning objects. And when we talked about learning objects, we had a specific definition for a learning object. As you know, on the web, there is lots of what we call learning resources. You can find collections of plants, pictures of pictures from art galleries. But if you show these to students and you do not attach to those resources a specific goal, a learning objective, you know, why am I looking at these pictures? What am I looking for? And you don't provide some feedback related to that goal to the student, you're typically not going to reach your learning objective. So we define a learning object as an interactive quality web resource that leads students to a learning goal via informed pedagogy. To reach that objective, we decided to not bypass faculty, but to include faculty, but reach the faculty through our students. So we proposed about 4 years ago, 2008 to be specific, to educate graduate students across disciplines to find quality online learning objects, learn how to evaluate them, learn how to design them, and disseminate them into courses, to infuse them into courses. So in a way, there was two goals here. We would not only be training graduate students, but indirectly be training the faculty on the what a quality online learning object was and how to infuse it into the course. In fact, that would be something we did find the project achieve. Now, we didn't completely overlook faculty, and our ideas were not simply based on something that flowed into our head. It was based on research. There was a lot of research done around this time showing that our faculty, at least at U of M, were not integrating technology into their courses because they didn't have the time, they weren't sufficiently informed, and so on. As I indicated, we were not going to overlook the faculty, so we proposed that we would involve the faculty in this way. The graduate students who we were training would go to the faculty of the involved course and find out, you know, what would you like to see to help your students in the course? What specifically are your muddy points? What are the difficult concepts? And what kind of learning objects would you like us to find? And so this particular slide shows the results of some interviews with psychology faculty in relation to types of learning objects they would like to see in the courses. And as you can see, the results vary based on the kind of discipline. So we see from psychology, they really wanted case studies. I'm in chemistry, I wanted animations. And in statistics, they wanted simulations largely. So in our proposal, we put forth a plan that it would involve a unique collaborative approach that we proposed would be time-saving because of the collaboration and speed up the infusion of learning objects into courses. So you would have your faculty members. You see here in green the graduate students. And this slide purposely has the graduate students in green because they were, we proposed, the people who would make this go. That's our green light. The other people that would be involved in the project would be IT support staff primarily. In the initial year, we said we'd start with three disciplines, and we did that. We started with general chemistry, psychology, and statistics. By the end of the start of the third year, we had nine disciplines involved, more if you count the sub-disciplines of each of the disciplines represented here. At this point, we were calling ourselves the Mellows. Mellow stood for Michigan Education Through Learning Objects. And the three D's after it were because we found ourselves delightful and delicious and all such nice terms. This was a better designation than the original title of the project, which was funded through the University of Michigan School of LS&A and ITT, and it was called a Ninny Grant. So we did not like being called ninnies. So we were funded, and in the initial year, all the graduate students, and I could tell you the faculty largely were not at these training sessions, it was the graduate students. We trained them in how to go online and find a quality learning object. What is a learning object? What is a quality learning object? And we used Merlot, which is an open educational resource site. Merlot stands for Multimedia Educational Resource for Online Learning and Teaching. And typically, they would be asked as one of their first assignments to find quality learning objects, attend the Merlot Grape Camp, which trained them also in what a quality online learning object is, and then on Merlot create a personal site with their collection of online learning objects. Next, they brought these to the faculty and shared the results with them and chosen from among the collection would be the learning objects that address specific course needs. And typically it would be a muddy concept, something difficult that the faculty member really wanted to focus on and test and see how it worked. And minimally, these were then either just put up within the course website, put into the syllabus, and as I said, every time we brought in somebody new, we'd do that process again, but it actually would be speeded up because as subsequent groups came in, we had everyone document their process and they were sharing. And we found out that in the second year, it went much, much faster because we had videos showing how they went through this process, what they learned from it, and everything started to go much quicker. So I'm bringing over Steve here, who's going to share another outcome from this project.
So
hello everyone, that's that.
Here's a couple of examples that are actually from psychology. And one of the things that we found over time through this project is that some graduate students just got stuck. That they couldn't find quality learning objects that could address the difficult concepts they're looking at. They're like, we kind of found Pavlov's dog. We found stuff that find simulations for illicit drugs that are neat and they're helpful, but it's kind of challenging to find quality LO. So actually, these examples are actually example of maybe kind of actually flipping the process a little bit. Because what the graduate student did is he actually challenged his own students to find quality learning objects to enhance the course. And they actually found quite a few. These are actually two examples of them. And so that graduate student shared that practice with the Mellow community, and the idea of leveraging students actually really caught on like wildfire and spread to other groups in this project. So here's one example of that.
So in chemistry, we said, well, wait a minute. If they can have such success in a small section, how about we try that in one of our smaller sections, in a subset? So it was in winter 2011, we put together a website and opened it to our small section of about 400 students. And on this website, there were links to open educational resource sites like Merlot. There was information for the students now about what is a quality online learning object. There were submission forms for the student to submit what they thought would be a good learning object for the course and where it could be put into the course. Some other rules were if once we had anything on a list that was posted on our website that we already had available, you could not submit that particular website. Well, it blew my mind. It blew the mind of many in the Mellow Project because we got over 100 submissions. And this was all for 1 point or 2 points or 3 points max if you got a best submission in a 500-point course. So I also had some students who said, well, could I submit something I'm working on and authoring? So this really began to change my mindset and the mindset of all of us in this project in terms of how students might be involved in the creation of curricula. So we began moving from this kind of model where students were not really just students and learners, but co-teachers.
So over time, what happened with a lot of these is that the Mellow participants, so both the faculty and the graduate students, became more convinced that using students to collaboratively build curricula is really the way to go. So this example of what happened through writing, this is actually an end product. So we're not going to show you all the process that went through and all the different iterations. But what happened is they interviewed a bunch of students in their process. And this was a concept in writing about revision. And if you've ever written a paper, it's like the whole revision process can be a struggle and it's hard and students don't want to do it. So they interviewed students, they got a lot of ideas from the students, and they built those videos into a website that's interactive, so it has both videos, you can see perspectives from two different students at the same time, or one right after the other, probably, more likely. There's also interactive components, so you can see different elements, you can take a little poll, see how other people are thinking, and really kind of leveraging the ideas from students within a product that is then for other students. So they can, it's actually Al November, if you've ever seen this TED Talk, talks a lot about leaving a legacy for students, and that these students have left a legacy for future writing students as well.
So this idea of student collaboration evolved from year 1.5 through year 3 and 4. But going back to about year 1, we found that students were reporting to us that we can't find learning objects on certain topics. Or we have something good here, but it really doesn't fit our particular course needs. Or here's something good, it doesn't have any goals, it's not, the terminology is different than what we use in this course. So in effect, they were telling us that there's some quality online learning objects out there, but they really need to be adapted if they're to be useful to our particular course. At this point, we had students going to some of our graduate students were sent to conferences, and at the Merlot conference, we had a group of about, and I forget what year that was, about 2010, we had about 12 graduate students and faculty that we sent to the conference, and they learned about new technology and came back being familiar with video capture like Jing. And so at this point, Brenda, who is tuned into us via Skype is going to share a video that she made on what happened at that point. Hopefully.
The statistics team discovered a nice learning object, an applet. It had great potential. It addressed a fundamental concept, confidence intervals, provided some excellent visuals. The user's able to adjust many of the controls, but it wasn't quite ready for our students to use as is. It was lacking learning objectives, no directions for how to use it. There were even some differences in notation. Rather than type up all the words that would be needed in a document to address these issues and ask our students to read it, we created a video wrapper with all of that information that our students could watch. It allowed us to tailor this learning object for our class, our students. This not quite perfect learning object, the lonely learning object about confidence intervals, went from this to this. The learning object was wrapped with a video that gave directives. It brought the learning object to the student in a more personalized way. The video wrapper was then housed in a site which included a roof, the objectives, and a basement, a short assessment piece. Here is what that full house looks like. The objectives at top, a link to the actual simulation, our video wrapper that guides the student in how to use this wonderful learning object, and a short assessment piece at the end.
Interestingly, when we were training the grad students to find quality learning objects and hoping that they understood what a quality online learning object is, we decided to conduct a training in the design of learning objects. But our goal in doing this was saying, if you design a learning object, then that helps you understand what a quality online learning object is. Well, we had no idea, no intention at that point, when we were teaching them design, that they would end up authoring learning objects. But this is what happened.
One skill that our students struggle with is recognizing what statistical procedure should they use to address a given research question or scenario. We have been giving our students some practice in the form of a worksheet, but we didn't find any existing learning object that did this well. In the first year of our project, we provided our graduate students with a workshop on designing learning objects. The end result was just a poster of that design or plan. A statistics grad student designed what we call Name That Scenario. And over the next year of the project, it was actually created by the stats discipline team with some great IT support. Suppose a student wants more practice at distinguishing between one proportion and one mean. They can read through the scenario and, based on what their knowledge is, select one of the options to see if they get it right. Or perhaps in some cases, they occasionally get it wrong, in which case they're given some explanation as to why they should be thinking in the other direction, giving some hints. We have made this available to our students and have received positive feedback. We are currently evaluating it for usefulness in terms of students' attitudes and how helpful they feel it is, also in terms of performance on assessments of this nature.
So we regularly had meetings about once a month, minimally, with the whole group. Sometimes it was twice a month, especially in the spring and summer semesters when everybody had more freedom, or this is the time we always really picked up our pace of involvement with the projects. So we had what we call show and tell. And so statistics was sharing their repped statistic pre-labs and what they were doing in terms of taking the design of a statistics, a new LO, and sharing it with others. And I have to tell you here, again, we had a lot of surprises in this project in terms of results, but we've had graduate students who have took their designs and went with it and have won awards. We have a psych student who won a Cengage Award, $2,000 to go to a conference, a physical chemistry student who used Wolfram Mathematica to design interactive questions on physical chemistry and was nominated for a Merlot Classics Award and ended up being the chief representative, chemist representative to Wolfram, now is working there full time. A fantastic outcome for involving students this way. And in addition, rappers took off.
Oh, did they ever. So this was something that, again, that a lot of folks brought back from the Mellow Conference. It was actually before I joined the team, but I heard lots about it. And there's this thing called Jing. And I'm guessing probably this conference, you know, you're all nodding. I had never heard of Jing. No idea what it was. And what was really cool is that it allowed you to wrap all this stuff. You create really short 4 or 5 minute, you know, screencasts, and you're able to create them for free, share them for free. And writing had this awesome idea of actually going through and how, you know, as she talked, as she was grading students' papers, instead of just kind of writing out all those comments and passing the paper back through the learning management system, she actually put that in a Jing wrapper and talked about your paper and said, this whole section, let me highlight it. You didn't have an introduction here. You didn't justify your point here. And it was really personalized feedback for students. It was really clear for them to say, oh, I did not get it. So other folks in the project used to start to wrap books for chemistry. Other disciplines began using Jing to quickly wrap and easily all their different content.
And let me tell you, we saved a lot of money in chemistry by wrapping the CRC handbook. Each edition of the handbook costs a lot of money. So, and guiding students as to how to look up things in the CRC handbook. But about this point, because we were adapting all these quality online learning objects that existed, we really got concerned with, are we allowed to do some of this? You know, there's this great stuff out there, but it's not quite perfect. Can we really take it from the web and adapt it? So when we applied for our second grant, which was in 2010, and it was granted, we said, you know what? We have to add to this picture of this collaborative team, experts in not only assessment and data analytics, but OER, open educational resources. What are they, and et cetera. So on came Emily Puckett Rogers into the picture, and she will tell you her contribution. She's over here in Skype, but let's listen to her.
Faced with barriers of no existing content available to adapt, or imperfect learning objects that needed a lot of additional content added to them, the Mellow Project decided to add me, Emily Puckett Rogers, from the Open Michigan Initiative to support the team of faculty members. Open Michigan helps members and content creators across our campus share their educational resources with the world. Our initiative helps the Mellow Project members create pedagogically flexible learning objects that are format adaptable, which means they can be edited, allow for collaboration, and provided the project with more visibility. Open education takes the perspective that education should be transparent, so you can see the process that leads to the results or the content, as well as that product. Collaborative, so teachers and learners from different educational settings can work together to create materials or to do instruction. And participatory, teachers and learners both contribute to the development of the classroom learning experience or learning resources that come out of that classroom. In order to do this, educators can license their own teaching resources to be legally reusable in new learning settings, publish resources using formats that can be edited by others, and add their resources to online collections for reusable teaching materials like Merlot or OER Commons. These resources are then considered Open Educational Resources, or OER for short. Many members of the Mellow group started incorporating these practices into their individual projects and incorporated students as co-teachers in the development of learning objects, as you see here in Organic Chemistry VoiceThread. All participants are trained on three features: how to find, create, and use OER. This training includes hands-on guidance on how to recognize and understand Creative Commons licenses, understanding how copyright and fair use work in digital and in in-person educational settings, and search techniques for finding collections of high-quality OER on the web, as well as guidelines for how to incorporate and adapt OER into existing or new resources. Almost all of the materials created in the process of this project are OER and are now available on the Open Michigan Collection. Now any educator or learner can see and use not only the product of this project, the learning objects themselves, but also can see and use the process of the project, all of the training we received, our evaluations and reflections, and associated course materials from the classes in which the learning objects were being used. The Open Michigan Initiative further supported the project by helping to collect, review, package, and disseminate this material. This has multiple benefits for the project. It shows the whole process of the project, making it useful as a model to other institutions. It makes the learning objects themselves more findable and legally and technically shareable across institutions. Allows the Mello group at the University of Michigan to build from existing resources, and also allows the group at the university to incorporate new people, technologies, and practices as the project evolves over the years. As you will see, several disciplines in the third year of this project fully incorporated open education principles and methods into the development of their learning objects and shared these and their classroom materials online as OER.
So, thanks, Emily. Who knew bandwidth would be so available? So one example from the project that really exemplifies a lot of these OER concepts and taking this whole kind of big collection of stuff and being able to leverage OER to make them accessible not only to the students in the class at that time, but then forward them out and make them available, you know, as to other places, other campuses, via Twitter, via Merlot, via other. So this is, we're going to have one of the graduate students named Frank. He's going to talk about the class History 373 and really how they made this transition from lecture to interactive meetings and leveraged OER concepts to move from a content-based pedagogy to integrating transferable skills, such as analysis of primary resources in their class. If it plays.
Hello, and welcome to this brief presentation. My name is Frank Kelderman, and I am one of the media assistants on Professor Michael Whitkin's History of the American West. Professor Whitkin's course is a 300-level survey course at the University of Michigan that introduces students to the history of the American West from the late 18th century to the present day. The goal of our project was to center students' weekly preparations on the interpretation of primary historical sources rather than on the textbook and course back alone. To do this, we produced this online syllabus, which allowed us to more efficiently bring together a range of primary sources available online in places like the American Memory Collection from the Library of Congress, the Internet Archive, and other online databases and learning tools. By embedding and linking to these sources and adding tutorials and study questions, we try to provide what Professor Whitkin has called real-time teaching tools that help students through the process of analyzing and synthesizing different historical materials. For example, this module is about a period during the late 18th century when Americans started moving into the Ohio River Valley and U.S. intellectuals were puzzling over the fact that they found the remains of ancient Native American cultures whose existence was not explained in the Bible or by existing intellectual discourses. Moving beyond the textbook and the course back allowed students to get an understanding of not only what knowledge early Americans had of Native American cultures, but also to reconstruct, as in real time, how this knowledge was produced. By linking to a wide range of texts from the time period around this topic, it became apparent that to students that knowledge was not stable at any given point. Instead, it was continually changing and contested. This practice of critical analysis and historical reconstruction happened not only during the midterm writing assignments, but was part of students' weekly preparation and self-study, Also, the open-ended nature of his modules helped to turn the stand-up survey lecture into opportunities for interactive mini-lectures, group work, and a back-and-forth with the students and the professors to reflect on the wide range of historical documents. The second year Professor Wicken taught this course in this format, we made a number of modifications. First, we made technical changes, such as working around links that would frequently break down, as well as standardizing the format of headings and subheadings to make the website more accessible for people using screen readers. Changes to the content mostly involved substituting even more secondary sources than primary sources to further cement the emphasis on process and critical thinking. Finally, we have begun to implement the same changes for a survey course on American Indian history also taught by Professor Wicken for the following year. Thank you for listening.
I coordinate and teach a large introductory chemistry class. It is lab-centered, but it has a lecture component, a pre-lab lecture, and a discussion component as well. This is a shot, a picture of the lecture hall, the 450-seat lecture hall where I give the lectures. One of the problems I've always been trying to address in this class is how to provide more personalized learning in a setting such as this. So imagine yourself in front of this large lecture hall, which is filled primarily with freshmen who are very heterogeneous with respect to their background knowledge and skills. And some are very insufficiently prepared in terms of background knowledge and skills, so that when they get into the laboratory, they really cannot function satisfactorily. So in a classroom setting like this, even if you can do some active learning, which is very difficult, the problem is it's not really personalized active learning. So a continuing question ever since I've been doing this, which is a long time, has been how can I make this environment more personalized and address the different learning needs of the students, like the underprepared student and the overprepared student. And then there was the problem of the room itself. I'm doing chemical demonstrations down in the front of this lecture hall that students in the back say they can't see, or they're the wrong color. I'm saying, look at the blue solution and it's looking red. So one of the things I did early on with the assistance of Ralph Williams, who's sitting back there, was to create videos of all the demonstrations. And I began folding that into my PowerPoints. And I suddenly realized, hey, I can use this to supplement my live demos. And then I found, wow, this is great, because now I can do time-lapse demos. I can do side-by-side demos so that you can see the before and after. And so this began a stepping stone to what would be a transition to this multimedia material that we would be providing the students in the hopes of providing more personalized learning. So at the time that was going on, the university also started recording by Blue Review our lectures. So I had podcasts of the lectures with these embedded demonstrations in them, and all the questions I was posing to students. And I began to think, gee, maybe these questions that are being posed in lecture to the en masse can be posed to the individual students. But I'm missing some components here in terms of accomplishing that. And at the same time, we discovered when I allowed students to look at podcasts of the lectures in advance of lecture, in a small summer class, I got a big shift in grades. And on the same exam that I had given the identical summer before, my B's shifted primarily into A's, and I was thunderstruck. And I said, gee, we have something going on here. Now, at the same time, this Mellow Project was going on, and we were creating a library of online learning resources that were available, becoming more and more available to the students. And there suddenly came the light. Ah, now with having also these interactive online learning resources, you have a way of addressing the underprepared students by providing additional links for that underprepared student, optional links. You also can provide links to the overprepared student to stimulate interest, applications to real life. But how do we do this? So I became aware of SoftChalk, which allows you to build interactive websites with Word hyperlinks, and it provides a means of providing interactive quizzes. And in summary, it's just a shot of one page. You've got your podcast slices from lectures that can introduce certain terminology and skills, additional resources, links, and it's put together in a framework that the student can follow through based on his or her needs. An early survey of the draft, and this has been repeated a couple of times, if you look at this survey, which the y-axis is 100% agreement, on most of the items listed here, the students agreed between 90 and 100% that this was a valuable addition to the lecture. It helped enhance their understanding, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The one bar that is low here, that one bar, is the different is indicates, and I'm looking at the wording here, can replace lecture. Students are divided on that. So we're looking into, you know, exactly what, why do they differ with respect to that. And so we're talking about looking at more data, and Steve's going to talk about data analytics.
More just analytics. So I got brought into the project same time as Emily because I like a lot of data. I live in data. So one thing that we talked about with the group, with this group, is that because it's so rich and it crosses so many disciplines, they have a variety of data available to them in different circumstances. So when I talk about how might we measure impact, it involves all sorts of data. It's not just analytics or, you know, raw ones and zeros data. It also is student achievement data, both formative during the semester and as well as summative, as well as student and instructor, instructor perceptions. So those perceptions help explain the why that you might see the what happening in the analytics. And we will share all the slides, so you don't have to rely on, you know, your Twitter picture, although we like being twit-picked. So just exposing that, talking about that a little bit more very quickly because we're running out of time, is the idea of formative and summative assessment, because a lot of some of the conversations we had this morning in our pre-conference seminar about learning analytics and a lot of talk out there is we all know that final grades, once it's been kind of like curved and summed or whatever, is kind of a poor proxy for student learning. But if you're able to kind of dig in and see, like, not only, you know, on a midterm, how well the students score, but on which item did the students score, and how as well as that item on that midterm related to the content that's covered in the learning object, we get much closer to see, did the student leverage the materials, which students leveraged them, which ones actually got the most bang for their buck, so we can start leveraging learning analytics that way. And then one of the things we learned from student instructor perceptions via surveys and interviews and focus groups is that, well, shockingly, if you have like 8,000 different resources in your learning management system and your learning objects are kind of buried in there, but if they can't find it, they probably won't learn from it. So iteratively, and also gives you some iterative development options. So the students give you some feedback saying, well, you know, design, you know, name that scenario works really great, but, the scenario about the ANOVA doesn't really make sense to me. So can you maybe tweak that a little bit more and make it a little more clear? So that helps us design learning objects even more better as it goes on. And we use a similar instrument working across these different disciplines. It allows for comparisons across the disciplines using a similar survey instrument. So we did that in one term. working across about three or four of the different classes. And we looked at familiarity with the key course concepts, related learning objects, whether or not those course resources that students claim to actually use those. We were able to compare that back with the Azure Analytics data to see, okay, are you being truthful-ish? And then were those used resources, what is your perception of how helpful they are, as well as some qualitative feedback as well. And all our instruments, again, we'll share the slides via EDUCAUSE, but all the instruments are also open source, and you're able to use those and tweak those as you like. And then, as I mentioned, we also like digital log data as well, which gives you, we use them primarily from our learning management system, and then there's also some student response data as well. Really start answering some of those who, what, and when questions. They don't necessarily answer why, necessarily how much, or the intent. Like, for example, if a student was accidentally clicking on a section of the LMS they didn't mean to. But again, it's really useful in conjunction with other data sources. So here's a quick example from organic chemistry. Nancy will quickly talk about it.
Very quickly, this is a shot of a spectrum. And students in organic chemistry have a lot of problems with spectroscopy. And so the participant in the Mellow Project, Ginger Schultz, had her students, she used VoiceThread, so students could collaborate on solving these problems, and they were able to annotate, you know, give each other's messages, or use VoiceThread to talk to one another. So the students are helping students learn. So again, this is something that's been infused throughout the project, students being co-teachers. But we also wondered about the impact this was having.
So very quickly on our impact is that, so in organic chemistry, they actually only exposed the voice threads and learning objects to one kind of section out of, I think, two or three. So it was kind of like a randomized controlled experiment for a bit. And they did find out that the treatment section, the ones that use these learning objects, actually outperformed their exam. It doesn't look like a lot in terms of numbers because they're 81 versus 87, but it's significant. And one of the questions we started asking is, well, do we even see a trend line? If you view the learning objects more, do you get a better grade? And we do see a correlation. It's not, you know, the steepest slope in the world, but it is a positive correlation. And one of the things we're digging into now that we have a little bit more time and we're not, the instructors aren't teaching as much right now, is we're actually able to dig more in. So what other folks have done is they've actually started teasing about maybe the freshmen are using learning objects more because they don't have as much experience, or students who come from particular disciplines use these more. So are we seeing bigger gains within the data for students who come from particular backgrounds or particular segments?
So we like to leave you with our big ideas, and that is, you know, move from a model where the students are not only students but engaged learners and co-teachers in terms of building the curriculum and contributing to the course. And technology integration by cross-disciplinary pollination is a really successful model. We urge you to consider it. Here is an example, Steve created this, showing how our social network within the Mellow Project evolved. It actually started with the UM Merlot community, of which I was a part and helped set up. And then people like our collaborators, Brenda Gunderson, came out of that community. And the green people are all the graduate students. And, you know, we have 12 faculty that have been directly involved, 5 staff. Those are 34 graduate instructors in that picture. We have impacted some 15,000 students in these introductory courses. And so we thank you for listening and hope you have some questions. We have a few minutes, and there's some contact information.
So just because I know the online folks are going to cut off, I wanted to first see if do we have online questions first. All right.
No.
So if you are in the audience here, go ahead and please come up, step up to the mic so the folks online can hear you. Sorry to make you move.
Thank you.
And if you have a question for Brenda or Emily.
Or OER specialists, they're on Skype there.
Hi. When you use VoiceThread, you would break them off into groups like VoiceThread. What size would your groups be? Because if you get 450 people in a lecture, four groups of 100 is still pretty overwhelming.
No, they because there's only one section, so I think it's still by the brown.
This was actually not used in the lecture. It was used in the laboratory component of the organic chemistry course. And so there's typically teams of three or four students. And so the teams would be working together and interacting, you know, either individuals within teams or with the other teams.
Yep. So three or four on a voice thread?
Well, no. The team, it could be up to eight, yes.
Okay.
Unfortunately, Ginger's not online to pitch in here. Well?
We'll hang out if you have more questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Oh, sorry.
Oh, question.
Did I hear you say that was a statistically significant increase in learning?
The correlation?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that was statistically significant. However, you know, because correlations don't account for N, you know, because it's such a big N, you know, almost any correlation is going to be significant with that big of an N. That's why we want to tease more into the data, because we think there might be a stronger correlation with a smaller subset of students. Yep, it's still significant. All right, thanks, everybody.
Thank you.